welcome to the Enduro World Series podcast, episode 14. Normally I sort of start these with a bit of a preamble about how busy we've been, Rory, but this week it's genuinely been particularly hectic, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been pretty manic and, in a good way. Obviously some big news.
Well, before we get into the big news, we should point out that perhaps the biggest news is that it's taken 14 episodes, but we're finally doing this podcast face-to-face, which... we've never done before. I'm in the fantastic confines of your own abode. We've got a door that is made from a middle door, and it's now a table, and we're just, it's a bit odd doing it face-to-face, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I forgot how gorgeous you were in person.
Well, no, you're just lying. Right, let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. A huge week for the Enduro World Series, for enduro racing as a sport, actually. With the announcement that Discovery Inc., the home of Eurosport and the Play Sports Group, which includes obviously GMBN, GCN, they now hold equity in the Enduro Sports Organisation Limited, which is us, the company that owns and operates EWS and EWSE. And what I think that means is that it's basically the start of, it's easy to get glib and come up with a load of cliches, isn't it? But this is the start of a whole new chapter for enduro racing.
Yeah, it's massive. I think, Discovery, it's a huge company, a huge conglomerate of various media outlets and channels. Like you say, Eurosport is owned by them, and, them investing in Enduro World Series is massive, not only for us as a company, but for the sport of mountain biking in general. Like, you know, a company that recognises the benefit of that and sees a future in it, it's exciting.
It's definitely, I mean, we're both obviously paid up members of the mountain bike sort of, the community, I think, in terms of obviously you with your racing, myself, I've worked my whole career in mountain bike racing covering that, and I don't, like... It's this news, this the signing of the Discovery Inc. deal, it definitely feels like one of those huge moments that hopefully, I mean, I remember as a kid seeing a World Cup being raced on Eurosport in an airport when I was coming back from, I think it was Tenerife with my mum and dad on holiday, and that really fired my interest in it. And I think my big hope for this is that we're going to be up there, we're going to be putting out the kind of broadcast that will just make people want to get into bikes. I think that's a really, really crucial thing. It's the beginning of a journey towards broadcasting the sport live. I mean, we're not... live is not something that I think we're going to get straight off the ground this year, but it's certainly something that we're going to be working full-time behind the scenes to recognise and to work out what that's going to look like and how we're going to do it. This is the scary thing, actually, about this whole thing, is that we've talked in theory around dinner tables and, like, on shuttle buses for years about how we would do live, and now it's like, all right, then, go on, figure it out.
Yeah, it's a lot more than it's a lot more complicated than just pressing go and saying, yeah, now we're live, you know. You've got to think of the course, you've got to think of the location, what the satellite signals are like, timing of the race, you know, how you best... kind of document it and make sure the right people are on screen. There's a huge amount of resources needed in order to do that, but also planning and the logistics involved. So, yeah, I mean, look, it's exciting. I think I'm similar to you in that when I started mountain biking, I remember seeing Mountain Bike Britain on Channel 4 on like a Sunday morning or something.
And, yes.
You know, I think, cycling and mountain biking specifically over the last few years have really became more and more popular, you know, even around here locally, the amount of people you see riding at the weekends and stuff is growing and growing, and I think it's reflective of the direction the sport's going, the reflective of the direction enduro's going, and how many participants and people are taking up the sport, and with that comes the demand for racing and people want to view it live. So exciting times, and we've got our work out.
We
by
do.
The sounds of things,
but, we do. We're excited about it, but
we're up to it.
Yeah, hopefully we're up to it. I don't know. They might get some professionals in. I don't know. I know it's something that, like, it's. I mean, it's the number one comment on anything we put on social media is, like, you know, when's it going to be live? Where can I watch this live? We've had spoof Facebook accounts from bots starting up about, you know, like, we are the live broadcast. Everything. I know talking to Chris Ball at like right from the very first practice day in Punta Ala, the very first EWS, people were asking when it was going to be live and when they could watch it live. And I think that's, again, crucially something that is unlikely to take place this year, but it's something that we're hopefully, we now have the scope to put the nuts and bolts together and actually work out how we can do it. And live aside, I think the big thing is that it's going to mean that we can bring more racing to more fans throughout the course of the year, not just during the race season, and give more access. It's something we're seeing in other sports, for example, Formula One, there's a Drive to Survive, isn't there? Like that, the sort of docu-series that's spun off there that has created so many talking points in terms of that sport. It's
And brought so many new fans to the sport. Like, I think it, when you kind of humanise the icons and the characters and you see the people behind the scenes, it really adds to the drama, and people want to see the personal side of it as well. But and it was nice of them. It was nice of Formula One to copy our pro stage concept for this year with the sprint race as well.
Yeah, so we should bring that up, shouldn't we? Formula One have gone for a sprint race, which you and I both know is our pro stage format this year. You know, so
and the pro stage, you know, when you talk about going on behind the scenes, the pro stage in a way was a kind of format that would not only kind of bring the race more central, but would provide a stage and a format that was easier to document on TV. One of the, you know, or broadcast live, one of the kind of ways, or one of the reasons for that was so we could create a race and have a stage that was relatively short, central location at the event hub. And with that comes a more convenient way of broadcasting it. So, you know, it has been ongoing a while, and you know we're making baby steps. But you know now the ink's dry. It's exciting, and we can really start getting our teeth into it.
I'm excited that the big thing I'm excited about is that neither of us leaked it. I think that's the big thing I'm excited about. That felt like a really very real possibility at times, because it's the nature of it, isn't it? You have this massive thing that is working away in the background, and you're just hoping and praying it stays online and no one leaks it. We should point out, if you can hear clicking in the background, it is the shutter of a premium interleaving based photographer that is Innes Graham.
I'm going to open a bottle of Highland Spring as well. If it sounds like a Fast and Furious car, it's just changed gear.
Yeah. There we go, So that's the...
Cheers, mate.
It's a particularly aggressive Highland Spring. It's a very sharp mineral water. I like
takes, it. Takes the line and out your mouth. We've not. Unfortunately, I didn't buy, because we've been so busy the last few days, I didn't buy you the 440ml Guinness glass. And it is midday on a Thursday, so probably wouldn't be the timing either. But
we did have a pint of Guinness last night though at dinner.
I had a pattern on the top. Unfortunately, you were.
I don't like people drawing in Guinness. I kind of think that's. That gets to a point where you're messing about with somebody's drink. I'd just pour it. Get to me quicker, I would say, is the expedience.
You definitely inhaled them a bit quicker than I did. I was
thirsty.
Yeah.
Right, well, let's just talk a little bit more about Discovery Inc., what that is going to actually mean in terms of Enduro World Series. I know that a lot of the fans have a lot of questions, and it's something that we actually need. I was thinking about this. We need to get a podcast sorted out with Neil or Martin or someone down from GMBN and have a chat with them about what they're excited about to do with this. But the big message that I think we need to stress is that broadcast is going to adapt to sport. We're not going to change the nature of the sport to fit the broadcast. We've got some different ideas about how we can do that and what is what kind of content we can provide from the stages. But the big thing is that we want to... You and I both know, like, when you're stood at the side of a stage and the top riders start coming down, it's such a buzz, and the speed is unreal. You said yourself, I think, last week that you were watching it last season, you couldn't believe that's the speed that you were travelling at, you know, and I think we want to bring that impact to more fans all over the world.
I think it's important to us that we retain the kind of spirit of enduro and the what's made the sport so popular up until now. We certainly don't want to go changing the format and the racing and the stage locations, etc., around broadcasting. I think the, you know, the remoteness of some of it and the big mountain kind of feel and the adventure aspect of it is really what people enjoy. And, you know,
it's basically how are we going to get cameras there? How are we going to get more cameras and to
Yeah, and I think, you know, with someone like Discovery on board, like the resources that they have and the knowledge and expertise that they have, it's that's kind of probably going to be the piece of the puzzle that up until now has been missing in order to do that. So
the big thing is if the sport's right, you know, if a sport is done properly, it provides the stories. You don't have to tailor a broadcast around creating stories. Sport will do that if it's run correctly, which I think it definitely is. I mean, let's talk about it a wee bit though, because it's been a roller coaster, hasn't it? Because last season, obviously COVID-19 heavily affected, like a lot of time on the road, because from our team, from our production team and yourself with the sports coordinate, like we couldn't travel home because the quarantine rules were changing all the time. We had to stay out. It was, you know, it wasn't just us, other sports were being affected, and it was like all the time this deal was kind of being talked about, and it was, you know, might happen. And it feels like, touch wood, we're on our way. I think COVID-19 will be part of life, I think, for the foreseeable future, but it feels like we're at a point now where hopefully this doesn't really work on radio, but I've just touched wood, that international travel starting to become an option again. And it feels like we've come out of that really harrowing, like, you know, really difficult logistical part of time, and we're emerging into something that is just so positive. And like,
yeah, I think if you look at all sports over the last kind of 12, 13 months and how they've had to adapt, pretty much everything sport-wise had the brakes fully on hold this time 12 months ago. And it's, you know, various ways that they've adapted and managed to work within that framework that is now COVID-19. And yeah, I think for us, it's been a tough 12 months. Obviously, we had the three races last year that, like you mentioned, were very complicated and very stressful in order to put on, but I think where needed. And then, you know, now going into this year, I think we've learned from last year, where obviously I think everyone's learned, the situation's developed, we know more about it. And yeah, I think for 2021 onwards, it will always be a factor, or it will be a factor for a long time, but it's important that we adapt and learn with it and make sure that we're putting on races responsibly and safely, and I feel like the plan for this year is very much to do that.
I think it takes, I mean, I wish it didn't take, but I think whenever you are exposed to something like what we experienced last year, the global pandemic at its worst, I think you do become aware of how important sport is to a lot of people, and how, you know, it was for us, you know, it was a distraction, it was something you could focus on, it's more than entertainment, it's sport's really, really important. And hopefully this new deal will mean that we can bring more of it to more people. We want to bring people closer to the fans, closer to the teams. I mean, you talked about venues have always been at the core of what the Enduro World Series does really well. We're very lucky, we get to go to some stunning parts of the world and not just ride, you know, sort of cookie cutter stages, but ride what the local teams there tell us. These are the best trails in the area. You need to race on.
Yeah, you know, they say, was it variation is the spice of life?
Variety is the spice of life.
Well, there we go. I mean, I was half right.
You
got the V right, but yeah, I think that was something for me, coming from downhill, where you kind of go to the same places year on year. And the tracks didn't change much to go into EWS. And obviously the first year was like, you know, it was all pretty much new. But then, you know, the next year again, it was like new again. So you started in Chile and Colombia for the first year as the beginning of 2018. And then the following season, you had Tasmania and Rotorua in New Zealand. And I think, obviously, that's tricky with everything going on. Obviously, the logistics involved. But I think it is important and it's not only that, but it's important for kind of local venues and local riders to really showcase the riding and almost kind of legitimize their kind of the riding scene. And you know, I'm excited to say that the plans are for that kind of essence to continue and to visit some new places and yeah, keep the spirit alive.
I think it, to be honest, even before I was into Duva, I thought it was a really interesting part of the Enduro World Series is that the idea that you roll up to a venue you've never been to before to ride terrain you've never potentially ridden before to then race other people on that terrain. But it's not just that, isn't a single thing that happens at every round, yeah. You know? So yeah, I mean, that's what I've always found very interesting about the Enduro World Series is that you, not only do you have to go to a new venue you've never been at before to race on trails that you've never seen before to be faster than everybody else before on those, but you've got to do it over the course of a season, which is just mind-bending, really.
Yeah, I think, yes, obviously performance at that level is tough anyway when you've got to do it in different climates, different cultures, different, you know what I mean, different conditions. You know, Rotorua was kind of like almost kind of jungle-esque, and certainly Colombia was, where it's that really hot and humid, and then you go to somewhere like Scotland and it's freezing cold.
You're saying that literally before we started recording this podcast, we were around at the cafe around the corner from yours, sitting outside, and because I'm a nice guy, I had to go back to the car to get us a couple of pairs of sunglasses because it was so bright. I got the sunglasses, sat down, had a sip of my coffee, then it literally started to snow on us.
Mm.
So it's...
And it's what? It's the last day of April last year.
It's the last day of... Yeah, that's pretty disappointing. Yeah. But listen,
come
anyway...
Come on, Scotland, sort it out.
Some really, really exciting times ahead, I think, in terms of just everything in Enduro World Series and EWSE. And yeah, we can't wait to properly dive into Discovery Inc. and find out what we can do. But listen, we talked about changeability and about riding bikes in Scotland, and we got to ride some bikes yesterday. Not only did we get to ride some bikes, we got to ride our new bikes, our Santa Cruz Bullets for this year. But we do have, we will be on Megatars for Enduro World Series duties, but we're currently on the sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark hunt for parts to build them up with. But we have both got Bullets, and I'm going to throw it out to you first. How was yours? And then I'm going to just regurgitate what you said because you know more about how a bike feels than I do.
I was seriously impressed, and I'm just saying that. I mean, to jump on a bike that you've never ridden before, we had some new tyres on there I've never ridden before.
Can't talk about the tyres.
Right. We had some tyres on there. I hadn't ridden them before.
We had two tyres each. That's all you talk about. I should point out, though, you're saying you just jumped on the bike and just to sort of get used to it and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You jumped on the bike. We rode up to the top of some trails in Innerleven, and we set the cameras up to make a little video that we're making about Rory. And you exited off a fire road at about 40 miles an hour into a corner, did a few turns and landed on your head.
The corner's okay. Matt, like, obviously, when you've got a bowling ball head like mine in a set of shudders, there might be a berm that's a bit flatter than it was this time yesterday, but, you know, the only way you learn is by pushing the limits. And
see, that's what you're doing wrong. I like to stay comfortably within my limit, and then...
I noticed that.
Yes.
But
yeah, the Santa Cruz Bullet, we should point out that was by no means the fault of the Santa Cruz Bullet you landed on your head. It is a tremendous, tremendous bicycle, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we spoke at length on previous podcasts about the direction that enduro bikes are going, and these kind of that this evolution of super enduro bikes. And the Bullet is kind of a, I guess, part of the same mould, but with a motor, right? As in it's... Comparison to the Heckler from last year, it's longer, it's slacker, more travel. You know, it comes as standard, comes with the mixed wheel sizes, so the 650B out back and 29 up front, which I think, for someone like myself who's a little bit shorter, you know, means I can get my weight back much more comfortably than I could on a full 29er. And when he had it up to speed, like we did some kind of filming high up in the kind of open fast section of Innerleithen, and the thing just, it's like a runaway train when you get it up to speed, and at times, you know, just completely forgot I was on an e-bike. It just handled that well.
I had a couple of big takeaways from it, I think. The first was that it felt very, very similar to how my Megatar feels, in that there's definitely a window of operation that once you cross a certain speed, and it's not like it's, like, this is me talking, it's by no means like the upper echelons of space. Like, you know, there is, once you get it rolling at a certain velocity, the thing comes alive underneath you and just eggs you on, and you hit it, you hit the next thing faster than the last thing. The speed you could carry out of stuff was really, really impressive.
Yeah, I noticed the bike, like on the choppy stuff, it really sat, I wouldn't say high in the travel's the word, but it sat in like a really good spot and just tracked, like it just stays on top of things.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't get hung up on, like, even in kind of bigger, choppier bumps, the bike would just sit high enough in the travel that it was on top the whole time, rather than getting hung up and you get in that kind of, you know, feeling of like the bike lose momentum at the kind of square edge faces. Like, it really just sat on the top and tracked across, which is great until you need to slow down, and then you realise you're going a lot faster than you think you
and
are.
And you're on an e-bike with a load of weight and you've got to pull the brakes quite hard. Yeah, but
and an extra 10 kegs for the rider, so... I mean,
an extra 10 kegs, but... I'd also, my other big takeaway was that, I mean, I think we've alluded to in a previous episode of this, that we did try and hot rod one of our other e-bikes with a bigger wheel and bigger fork, and it sort of didn't really do it much good. And I was quite aware when I rode that bike that my rear wheel was smaller.
Mm.
But I had to keep reminding myself on the bullet that it was a mixed wheel size bike. It doesn't, you don't get like a...
It feels very neutral.
It feels very neutral. And I would say on one of the trails, the first trail we filmed on yesterday, where we were doing some drone stuff in the trees, where there was lots of sort of like rutted turns one after another, that I definitely felt the sort of ping in and out of ruts really, really nicely, really solidly. Mm-hmm. We've got the numbers in front of us at the minute compared to the Heckler, which was the bike we spent a lot of last year riding. I'm on an XL, so the head tube angle is 64 degrees for the bullet, 65.5 for the Heckler. The reach on the bullet, 495, whereas the Heckler was 490. The seat tube angle on a bullet is 77 degrees, whereas the Heckler was 75.9. So you do sit in a nice place on it as well. It does climb very, very well. One of the big things, we're talking about geometry, and we're talking about how a bike enters and exits corners, but from an e-bike point of view, one of the things I was really, really impressed with was the Shimano EP8's overrun feature, where...
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Nice one, I've stolen that from you. Right, I'll keep talking about that. You think it's something else clever to say. So if you've spent any time on older generation e-bike drive units, what would occasionally happen with them is that they would only really activate when you put pressure on the pedal, and they'd obviously cut whenever you weren't pedaling. What that can lead to, especially for what Rory's dealing with, is for things like the power stage, is that it can often make technical climbing quite tricky because it's stop start on or off, whereas the new one, the new EP8 drive unit from Shimano, has a function where the motor runs on after you stop pedaling. It's only a fraction of a second.
Yeah, it's probably like a quarter or half crank, maybe like a couple of wheel lengths, but it gives you that kind of free. Like, you can let off the, you know, I mean, you can take your foot off the gas a little bit, or you have that little bit of free play in the cranks where it just runs on. You can kind of rebalance and keep going without having a stop start.
That was what I sort of spent a lot of last summer trying to do, was trying to learn how to pedal absolutely everywhere smoothly, because that was the only option you had. Because if you stopped pedaling, you lost the torque from the motor, which meant then that you become unbalanced or clip out or dab a foot or something. So I thought that was really, really good. I thought the way as you've mentioned, the way it tracked the ground. And this, but bear in mind, we built these bikes. We should say a big thank you to everyone at Tweed Valley Bikes for letting us take over their workshop and disorganise all their tools, disperse their tools across quite a wide area for a day and a half. The guys there were brilliant. Nick and Dan especially, who were helping us. This was our first day on the bike, so there's obviously all, I always, I always used to kind of think that your first ride on a bike is always, it's usually slightly disappointing because you've spent so much time and effort getting it, then you get on the thing and you realise that all the suspension settings are a bit far out from where you're gonna end up with them. The controls are a wee bit oddly spaced, and like, look, we've only just got the bikes, so it's by no means a final review of them. But
I think the first thing I noticed when I jumped on mine was I didn't actually turn it on. I jumped on it and was like really surprised at the little drag there was from the motor. Like, it almost felt like a normal bike.
That's interesting. When you stop pedaling as well, that's not to say the older, the E8000 was really, really bad for it, but you were aware that there was maybe a bit of resistance there that there wasn't with a regular normal bike. But the EP8, you stop pedaling, the thing glides along like with absolutely no resistance at all.
Even the motor's off, like, I mean, you can, like, if I was riding around the corner, two valley bikes, I wouldn't even bother turning it on. I can ride it around with it off, and it just feels like a normal bike. And you know, that's obviously pretty good for when you evidently run out of battery because you've been trying to bite off more than you can chew, which will be good for later in the year.
Yeah, it will. It will definitely. Should we talk about with those bikes? And we're full Shimano XTR because we're posh like that. We were on XTR, the latest generation, last season. Again this year, brakes more than up to the task. Really, I'm a big fan of Shimano brakes. Have been for a long time. We can't talk to you about the tyres. Let's not mention the tyres again. Rory is on the, what's yours called? Is it just called bronze?
You call it Gordon Brown.
Gordon Brown.
Because it's kind of a bronzy brown colour, but I'm not a huge fan of the name, but
it's growing on me, the colour. It's almost red in certain lights, that brown.
Yeah, I think in the sun it's you know, in the sun when it's gleaming off it, and you know,
it's the colour of the heller on the hill.
And the bike's going like a train, then it's fine. But I mean, I for the best part of the last however many months thought I was getting a lavender one, which you got.
Yeah.
Which, when it was all built up, I wasn't that offended by. I thought it suited you very well, Rick.
I am a huge fan of the colour of that bullet. And I would say, as somebody who owned previously a fry sauce pink Megatar, that it doesn't necessarily photograph as good as it looks in the paint. Like, the fastest thing about Santa Cruz is that their paint and finish and overall detail of their bikes is to a level that it almost doesn't matter what colour they are. When you see them in the metal, you're like, no, that works. And I think that lilac bike is really a case in point of that. I wish they'd given it a cooler name than lilac, but
I think, yeah, like, seeing it all built up with all the new shiny Shimano XTR parts, it was like, then and there you go, well, that is a good looking bike. And I feel very lucky to have them, considering the shortages with parts
Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz has been really good. Our bikes are actually, they're from the press launch, I think, actually. So, you know, that's such as a sort of mad scramble it feels like the bike industry is in at the minute. Definitely really, really excited to spend more time on the bullet and get back to some home trails and sort of work out where all the clickers need to be. And do you feel yours is miles off, or?
No, I don't think so.
Didn't seem to be slowing you down much yesterday.
No, I don't think so. I think the good thing about the Shimano stuff is, you know, we were used to it last year, so that's just a bolt on, and you know exactly how you want it.
Mm-hmm.
Suspension wise, it's a little bit different. I thought the bullet was I thought it was more progressive than the Heckler. Obviously, you've got more travel on there as well, and for me, I've gone from a medium Heckler to a large bullet, so I've gained kind of 30 mil in reach, so, you know, over an inch. Anyway, so there's quite a lot going on, but I felt I could have went a little bit softer in the rear just with how kind of much progression it had and how it ramped up. The fork, I think once it bedded in, I'll probably put a bit more air in that as well. I'm not a huge kind of nibbler when it comes to settings. I think...
Get it where you want it, and then...
For me, I try and find the majority of the performance through the air versus the compression, because I feel that if you get to a point where the fork has a lot of compression on versus not much, when a lot of compression's on, there's a lot of, basically you're closing down the shim stack and you're effectively choking the choking the fork, and that's how you get it to ramp up or to get to be stiffer. And for me, I've found that the more compression you have, the less free it moves in the travel.
Okay.
So I tend to run it with more air and less compression. So I like to have the compression dials fairly open, so it has a much more natural kind of feel to it. Whereas I feel if people with they put back, you know, loads of high speed and loads of low speed, you end up with a fork that is almost gets a bit confused as to what it's doing.
Yeah. I would say one more thing we should mention is, and this is built off what you were saying about getting your settings dialed in, the front end of that bullet feels mighty. It really does. Like it, where I struggled with the Heckler slightly was as somebody who's basically like an elongated Mr. Tickle in terms of like height and limbs.
A bit hairy.
Bit like a hairy, elongated Mr. Tickle, is that I've always, the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, ridden 29ers. And I think once you get your mental gyroscope dialed into the front end of a 29er, stepping back to a 27.5, I mean, it's not like, they're by no means awful, but there are certain cornering, like, certain aspects of cornering that you just can't get comfortable with them on. Mm. And I think that straight away on that bullet yesterday, although it was brand new, that Fox 38 factory fork with a big wheel, with a tire we can't tell you about on the rim, it just, like, so much confidence straight away that I've got on bikes before, and you know that there's a good bike in there, you're just going to have to get it set up properly. But on that yesterday, I could get on it, and I knew it wasn't the finished article in terms of how I'll eventually get it set up, but you were just throwing it into stuff with complete confidence that the front end wasn't going to do anything weird, it wasn't going to wash, it wasn't going to hang you out to dry. It was just, yeah, no, that's a great bike. I'm looking forward to a bit more time on it.
Yeah. No, me as well. I think...
Quiet as well.
Yeah, it was quiet. I think there's a kind of stability and level of grip that you get with the 29 front wheel that, if you're used to it, is difficult to go back from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that was why we, last year, were pretty keen to try and find an old set of forks and get our Hecklers. With the 29er on the front, but I think we've spoken about this at length on the podcast previously. Is it makes sense, you know, having the front end higher and the back end a bit lower with the mixed wheel size? It just neutralizes the geometry of the bike, and, you know, if you're setting up a bike to ride down a trail that's between, say, 10 and 30 degrees of slope, having a bigger contact patch on the front, the bigger wheel, giving you a more neutral geometry, puts more weight through your feet. Obviously, the smaller wheel at backs allows you to move around more. Obviously, the forks are going, like you say, the 38. It was the first time I've ridden one of them and was pretty impressed. And it all makes sense to the bikes then being geared towards purely descending. And I think the comfort and the trust that you have at the speed you go with, yeah. Very impressed.
It would be, yeah, I already, I think what we're both talking about is a bike that, if you had one eye on a bike that you could ride all the time, that would also be a great bike to go and race an EWSE on. I think that sort of, I always think that, like, race bikes, you don't want something that's really edgy, that's going to take a lot of work and a lot of puzzling to unlock. You want that comfort and neutrality that you can just get comfortable on and race. I think it's a perfect bike for that. the reason why we were, other than the fact we wanted to go and ride new bikes, the reason why we were messing about on new bikes yesterday was the fact that we are putting together a little video series around your, I mean, no pressure involved in this statement at all, your quest to make the perfect EWSE race course here in the Tweed Valley for the end of the season. The Santa Cruz Bullet is obviously going to be the bike you do it on. One thing we didn't film, we did a lot of drone stuff, we did a lot of aggressive trail riding, descending stuff yesterday. One thing we haven't really done on it yet is proper climbing, like power stage, pure stage. But seat tube angle, as I say, a little steeper on the Bullet. Smaller rear wheel and a front wheel. You think, how do you think that's going to compare? Because when we, I have talked to Seb from Santa Cruz, and he said that that's where the Bullet kind of shows that the Heckler is the more trail bike.
Yeah, I think obviously if the, you know, if you have a if you have a geometry that is geared more toward, or and the wheel size is geared more towards descending, if you flip it and you then got a climb, then it does change things, right? As in like, but I haven't found it negative at all. I think, like you say, the steeper seat tube angle is a big positive. I think the improvements in the EP8 motor is very good as well. I think the way you climb an e-bike, if you've done it to the extent that we have, and to try and get up some of the stuff that, you know, Big Jim put in Pietra last year, like some of those trails were, I think some of the climbs were steeper than the descents, you have to ride it in a completely different way. When you do climb on an e-bike, if it's very steep and very technical, what you tend to do is have the seat lower. Like, you wouldn't have the seat...
You drop it about an inch, don't you?
You wouldn't have the seat fully up like you would if you were climbing a normal bike, so like where your leg's effectively straight at the bottom of each pedal stroke. You kind of tend to have it, you know, 2-3 inches. Sometimes if it's really steep, almost completely down, and then you kind of hinge at the hips and get your torso and head over the handlebars to keep the weight down. This is where we've kind of laughed about the introduction of, we're going to see the return of Talus forks and
I thought and about this. Sort of I've got a new, and not to give away million-pound ideas for free, but I've got an evolution of my return to travel adjust fork theory, of the removable understem spacer. So I'm not trying to. I don't want to. Like, I just do ideas. I don't do fleshed out stuff, but I don't know, you could have some kind of, like, you could be at the bottom of the power stage, out come the Allen keys, spacer removed, bar drops down, spacer above bar, win power stage, stop, Allen keys back out, reverse it, off you go.
I'd be spending the rest of the race trying to get my stem straight on. I hate adjusting the stem.
We've had a conversation about this, I'm sure, in that we take, obviously, with travelling, we take bikes in and out of bags quite a lot. And there's two schools of thought with this. Of, you take either the bars off and leave the stem on, or you take the stem off. And I...
Here's one for you.
Go on then.
Can we do something where fork manufacturers make a mark on the back of the steerer tube for dead centre, and a bit where stems leave a little gap where you can see it, and it would solve everything?
Why has no one thought of that?
Because they like seeing people suffer. Nah, I don't know. It'd be much easier than making like a groove in the steerer tube, or it'd just be a bit of laser etching. If anybody that's listening out there, do it.
They do it with handlebars. Like, there's also there's indexed little notches.
Exactly.
Where
can you imagine if handlebars had no...
I'm worse with handlebars, and I can get my stem straight, I'm fine with that, but if the roll of my bars is wrong, it makes me want to do a sick in my mouth a bit.
Yeah, I always find rolling bars is a funny one, because I think people, what they do is they always put all their controls on, so their grips, their brake levers, their dropper post, their shifter, they put all that on, put it on the bike, and then they hold on to it all and then see how the bar feels once all the paraphernalia is already attached. It's like, you should put none of that on, sit on the bike, put the bars in with the grips only, and then get the idea of what you want. Because if you go like that and your brake lever suddenly rotates back like 10 degrees, it's going to feel rubbish. So... yeah, and obviously different bars have different sweeps, and, you know, I still think that like 90% of the people out there are riding bars too wide for them, but that's maybe a different discussion altogether.
I don't know. I like them wide though. I just like, and
what
again,
do you, what do you run?
800s. Get them wider if I could. I want to get them like, do you remember ODI did the bar with a screw on extender? We get a set of those, get them wider. No, I.
Maybe you could put that on top of your steerer tube and you. But that's what you attach your stem to when you're descending.
But I do, like, that's the thing though. But if I do that, that old, I don't know how much science is in it, that old, like, you know, you put your elbows up and your hands in front of you, like, that feels like the right width for me. And I know that Baller rides his narrower, and I get on his bikes, and I rode one of his bikes the other day when we were in Glentress with my daughter, and I was like, that it doesn't feel, but then I don't know, does it not feel right because I've conditioned myself to say that I need a wider bar? Don't know. What do you run at the minute?
I run 780, but I have this tendency to put my brakes quite far in, as in the... I'll put the clamp probably, I would say, between like 15 and 25 mil further in than most people I know. And what that does is it puts the center of my hand on the center of the grip. So really, I'm probably running about 760 actual riding, but the width, because I like kind of 10 mil sticking at each side of the grip.
This is a different conversation because I'm exactly the opposite in that I have to have the outside of my hand on the edge of the grip. Like, I just, that's where, like, I've tried moving them in board more, but that's why I've got two little fingers that are basically 90 degrees the whole time, because I whacked them off so many trees. But.
Yeah. Tell you what else I don't like, or maybe, yeah, I don't like it, but personal preference, I don't like grips that don't have a taper up at the outside. If you have a grip that's just completely flat and then just an end, not for me. I feel that my hand wants to like externally rotate down. I like having that little bit of support on the outside just to bring my elbows up a little bit. And
I don't know. Yeah. I always thought it was... I rode a lot of BMXs when I was a kid, and that's why I creak so much now. But that was always like... That was always that your hands were always like... Until that sort of horrible early 2000s trend when they went dead narrow with the bars, and I kind of got out of BMX with that. But...
Now they're running like broom handles 6 foot off the ground.
It's I don't get that either. But right, let's get away from us being old. Road to the Tweed Valley, new video series we're working on. We're gonna shoot a bit of that throughout the year. And it's gonna sort of hinge around you working out this EWSE course. And you're spoiled for choice around here, aren't you? Because it's if you're listening to this and you haven't been to the Tweed Valley with your mountain bike before, I've been coming here for God knows about 12, 13 years on and off for different bits of work and bits and pieces, and obviously a lot more lately with Enduro World Series and stuff like that. And I am no closer to piecing together. It's up there with Finale and Whistler for me in terms of places you can go, lose yourself in, have one of the best riding weekends of your life, and then come away not having scratched the surface off.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, I think.
And you've got to throw all that at the wall and then dissect the EWSE course out of
obviously
it.
The EWS course and EWSE course are going to be separate, so that then makes things a bit more complicated, as it effectively kind of doubles the size of the footprint for the event. But spoiled for choice a bit, and I think it's tricky. It's with EWSE, it's not just about having good stages, it's about having good liaisons. You know, what if we had a EWSE race and riders were just going up fire roads on e-bikes, it's not really what we envisage the sport to be. And I think anybody that's ridden an e-bike and has kind of, like us, discovered the fun and the challenge you can have from trying to climb technical trails.
Yeah.
You know, it makes riding an e-bike, even if you only go out for an hour, and if you pick the right trails, it is like an hour full on technical, physical fun. Like it's amazing. And I think it's trying to kind of encompass that in a course. So it is proven pretty difficult. I've lent on a few people to kind of, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? Like, ride this, tell me what you think. And obviously I think with the trail network around here being so so kind of big and so vast. It's also good having a lot of good riders around here that I can kind of,
you know. I do not envy you, Trent, because the level of riders around here, obviously Downhill World Champion, Rhys Wilson's just around the corner, Katie Winton, yourself, Lewis Buchanan, like that's just that generation. There's a generation behind you coming through now full of like 12 or 13 year olds that are comfortably as quick as some pros I know. You know, it's an exciting place to be, and it feels like, I don't know, I kind of feel that this is going to build, obviously, as we go through the year, and whoever is going to produce the video is obviously going to do a dynamite job of that. But, like, I kind of feel like this place is waiting already. It's waiting on that Enduro World Series final race, isn't it? It's waiting for the championship to come down here. I'd love to arrive here with everything perfectly balanced and the title on the line. To be honest, in Enduro, we do see that more often than not. You know, it's not, I think in other disciplines like downhill and cross country, some people can just get on a roll and they've got it, and you arrive three quarters of the way through the season and it's done and dusted. Enduro doesn't tend to be like that. There's a lot more variables. You're on bikes for a lot longer, which inevitably means that more can happen. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we can arrive in here with a race to do the no doubt masterpiece that is going to be your EWSE course, Justice. Look, listen, let's wrap this up here, and then what we'll do is, I'm going to propose this now confidently, having not talked to you about it, is we'll both spend a bit more time on these Santa Cruz bullets, and let's reconvene in a couple of episodes' time and sort of talk about what we've changed, what we've found, what we like, what we don't like necessarily, and how we think both our bikes are doing. The Lavender, we haven't got a good name for the Lavender one, so if you could maybe drop a message in the comments to get, because we've got Gordon Brun for Rory's
if you
bronze.
Think about that was Rick's off the cuff one. If you think of a better one, comment as well, because
yeah,
I feel it's more bronze than Brun, but
it's Brown.
It's just if you're not Scottish, that's explained for you.
I think we should have created some kind of social media thing around the fact it's the same colour as the Heller on the top of the
shape. We should open up like name our bikes.
Should we? Is that a good thing?
Well, we could. I mean, if they're dreadful, we can just pick the beginning order them.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's true as well.
If they're
good,
we can use them and take credit for it.
That is true. Yeah. So listen to this. Then nip over to our Instagram, find the tile that plugged this episode, and if you could leave suggestions for nicknames for our bikes, and we'll use them for the rest of the year if they're good.
And PC,
yeah. Come on, we're all adults here, right? Anyway, Rory, thanks very much. Speak to you next week.
Yeah, good to see you in person, mate, and looking forward to seeing you through the computer next week.
It's definitely Guinness O'Clock, right? See you in a wee bit.